Thursday, April 16th. Cloudy, 50-50 chance of some morning rain, a high of 60 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. It's overcast, 43 degrees across the board for Racine, Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, hosting a children's literature book sale this Saturday from 9 to 1 in the Hedberg Library. The sale will feature children's and young adult books. Hardcovers will be on sale for $3 and paperbacks for a buck. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll be spending the first part of today's program with Robert Hasty from the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, talking about their next concert, which is coming up this weekend, part of the Kenosha Symphony's glittering and exciting 75th anniversary season. We'll also give you a little sneak preview of a lovely Gilbert and Sullivan work, which is being presented this coming weekend, with as a collaboration between the Choral Arts Society and the University of Wisconsin Parkside. That and much more coming up on today's morning show here on WGTD. That's some of the most famous music ever composed by the great American composer Aaron Copland. Stomp Your Foot, the hoedown music, which comes from his opera, The Tenderland. It's one of a number of wonderful works of music that will be performed this coming Saturday evening for the special concert, which is rounding out the 75th anniversary season of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. I'm really excited to have conductor Robert Hasty on the phone with me to talk about Saturday night's concert, which is being called Our Town, a salute to the city of Kenosha and its history and the long legacy of the Kenosha Symphony, as these and other marvelous works by Copland will be played along with the New World Symphony of Antonin Dvorak. Promises to be a great night of music. And Maestro Hasty, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Good morning.
It must, first of all, feel good to look back on what has been a very successful 75th anniversary season. Recount for our listeners, for anybody not fortunate enough to have taken in what's happened thus far, just remind us of where the symphony has already been.
Well, we started the season celebrating, and we celebrated with the performance of the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven, where we got to collaborate with a couple other choirs, with Vox 3 from Chicago, and of course our own singers from Carthage College. With that, I thought it was very, very successful, and a great way to start the season, a great way to celebrate the anniversary of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. After that, we decided to also celebrate the other singers in the town by inviting members of church choirs and community choirs to join us for Handel's Messiah, and, well, at least selections from it with the Hallelujah Chorus, or with our December concert. And when Sarah Gorky and I were planning the season, it seems like we're doing a lot of choral music, and that is a great way to bring in the rest of the community into our performances. By doing so, this time we've got a couple generations of singers, by including high school students from Tremper High School, as well as our friends in the Kenosha Chamber Choir, who are going to be singing along with us on this concert. And this concert is special because it's not just, obviously celebrating with great music, but it's focused on the theme of our hometown by selecting music that focuses on not just our hometown, but our country, and as a way of really celebrating the time that the symphony has been in Kenosha. And then, of course, we will get a chance to do some more music in June by focusing on more popular music, by a lot of movie music that we're going to be doing, as well as focusing on the music of George Gershwin.
Right. I keep talking about this as the concert which ends the season, and it sort of feels like that in some ways, and yet there is this wonderful concert coming up on June 13th called Summertime and the Living is Easy, which actually promises to be just as delightful as everything else. So we want to be clear that there's actually two concerts that remain in this 75th anniversary season.
That concert will be completely different than what we've done before, focusing completely on being a Pops concert and a way to celebrate the beginning of the summer and the end of the season, something I'm really happy that our wonderful board of directors and our executive director thought it would be a great idea to add one more concert, but make it completely different theme, and it's also going to be in a different place.
Right, at beautiful Francis Bedford Hall at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. I'm guessing that's maybe a space you haven't yet seen.
Correct. I haven't been there yet.
It's a beautiful place, and I think you'll have fun there. Let's talk now about Saturday evening's specific musical offerings, and there really are some terrific things on this program. And we should actually probably begin with, in a sense, the musical namesake of the evening, the music that Aaron Copland wrote for the 1940 film of Thornton Wilder's Our Town. Tell our listeners a little bit about this music.
Well, when we planned the season, I would say that the idea of performing Our Town, I remember I was just sitting across from Sarah, our executive director, and I believe it was she who suggested it when we were talking about the season. And I don't think either of us at the time knew that we were sharing the same anniversary, that we were sharing the same number of years, that the Kenosha Symphony was started in the same year that this music from Our Town was written. And so I think that's very special. I think just a way of paying tribute to Kenosha, this piece is a wonderful way to portray it. It'll start the second half of the program, or I would say maybe the last third of the program, because the first program is the symphony. Our Town is special because it brings in the continuing a legitimacy of music for film. Right now, I would say that most of our culture says it gives a lot of legitimacy to film music. It's become probably one of the most dominating forces in classical music, in the fact that we have wonderful modern music today that's written for the film medium. And Copland, back at around this time, he had just finished writing the music for Of Mice and Men, and that was his first film at the time. And this was something that he didn't know a lot about. I even read something about he was a little confused why the composer wasn't a part of the movie music, the movie-making process from the very beginning, because he learned that he doesn't get to write the music until the film is completely made and he gets to watch it. So So he thought that he was a little confused by that. But then after he watched Of Mice and Men, he understood it better. With Our Town, just like the title says, it focuses on a town, although the town in the play, it focuses on Grover's Corners, which is in New Hampshire. But it focuses on just the day in the life, a time in the life of a community. And I think that that's kind of what we're focusing on right now with Kenosha. We're focusing on the fact that there's an aspect of it with people who are coming together and making music from all different walks of life. Yes, this is a professional orchestra, but we do have people in the group who do other things. We are bringing in the high school students to sing with us later on in the program, and of course some of the adult singers as well. But this is a great American response to how the life of a town goes. And this play is just very beautiful. It's very dramatic. And I just think it's very, very appropriate for this concert.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear just a moment of this. This is a recording conducted by Mr. Copeland himself. Again, this is the suite drawn from his film score to the 1940 film Our Town. It's really hard to break away from something so gorgeous, some of the most beautiful music that Aaron Copland ever wrote for his film score.
I think that one of the reasons why it's so important is that it's music that reflects on the history of that town. And when he wrote it, the war was coming. There was an impending war, and it's told in a flashback way. Where the narrator at the beginning is talking about what things used to be like and looking back. So it's about, we're talking about a pre-war perspective of something that was 40 years prior. So it's actually reflecting on the history of the town going back 40 years to the turn of the century. Mm. And Copeland was really trying to, by using some beautiful harmonies, he had experimented with some of the modern ways that the 12-tone system, but this was kind of right towards the beginning of his populist method of composing, to try to translate the transcendental aspects of this story and using some very easy harmonies to project that.
So Copeland's Our Town will be featured on the concert, and also on Saturday night you're going to be doing the suite that is drawn from his opera, The Tenderland, which will involve the guest choirs actually in two different pieces, two very contrasting pieces, each really terrific, of course.
Exactly. I think it's kind of funny, we talked about Our Town being movie music, and Copeland, when he wrote the music for Tenderland, he intended that to be for television. So the second half of our concert is going to be movie music and television music. There's an opera that he had written to hopefully be, put on TV. Unfortunately, it was actually rejected by NBC and was performed later with the New York City Opera. But it didn't meet with very good reviews, probably because it was written for TV and it didn't work so well on the stage. This is very similar to Our Town in the fact that it focuses on American life. We're focusing on just some of the aspects of this time it's on Depression era life and bringing in a lot of elements. So you've got, as you said earlier in your program, the hoedown aspect, but then we also have, which is probably the most popular piece from the opera, The Promise of Living, which is a beautiful way to round out the program, just a beautiful celebration of life, not just life, but American life.
And, of course, on the concert as well will be the most famous of Dvorak's 9 symphonies, the symphony known as Symphony of a New World, or From a New World. And, of course, this includes another of those immortal melodies among the most beautiful and famous ever written.
Absolutely. Again, we're tying the theme. So I would say that the beginning of the concert focuses on a foreigner's perspective of life in the United States, whereas the second half of the concert focuses on an American's perspective on life in the United States. So it's kind of like having two different worlds, a great way to approach this concert. This music was in response to Dvorak being in the United States. He was the National Conservatory in New York was looking for an artistic director, and they were trying to find someone to help America find a national music of its own, which I believe we found with Aaron Copland. You have that in the second half. But Dvorak came in, and so he took a vacation, and he came out here to the Midwest, and specifically Iowa, specifically Spillville, Iowa, and he wrote the New World Symphony in 1893. And what you were talking about, the theme, one of the most famous themes in the second movement, was in response to him being introduced to the music of African Americans, specifically spirituals, and the going home melody has become almost one of our national anthems. Something that is very familiar. People who may not even be familiar with classical music know that. Some of the other important elements, I think, in this one is that he still kind of brings in some of his European folk dances. I believe the secondary theme in the first movement is imitates folk dances that he heard in Bohemia. So we still get his European influence, but then we do have our African-American influence. And then the third movement, he had, long before he came to America, he had read Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, Hiawatha, which is the story of a Native American hero. And Dvorak actually said that his scherzo was suggested by the scene at the feast where the Indians dance. And so when you listen to the third movement, you can certainly hear with the drumming and with the way the strings play that this is a definite allusion to Native American dance. And so he studied the Native American melodies, and that inspired this movement. And just as an aside, I also feel that it's an allusion to Beethoven's Ninth, which we just performed as well. So when you hear the beginning of the third movement of Dvorak's Ninth, which I grew up calling it Dvorak's Fifth, they changed the numbers over the past 40 years.
That's right. They rediscovered the earliest symphonies and... So
That's
five
right.
symphonies became 9 symphonies.
Exactly. So I grew up calling it fifth. Now we have to call it the ninth. But so I don't think he said, hey, I'm going to throw in a melody from Beethoven's ninth in my ninth. I don't think he knew what the numbers were himself. But when you hear the opening, it sounds like Beethoven's ninth with Native American tendencies in that one. So also in 1893, Dvorak actually did visit this area. He visited Chicago, and he visited the World Columbian Exhibition, and he loved his visit. And it was first performed in December of that same year, 1893, at Carnegie Hall, and received a lot of praise. Hmm.
Well, that's a absolutely wonderful addition to the concert as well. We want to remind everyone that Saturday night's concert, 7:30 p.m., is at beautiful Reuther High School Auditorium, and it will again include not only Dvorak's New World Symphony, but also music of American composer Aaron Copland, as we've been talking about, with two guest choirs on hand to lend their beautiful voices to what promises to be a tremendous night of music. If people want more information, they can call the Kenosha Symphony at 654-9080. Tickets will be on sale at the door, and you can also visit the symphony's website, which is KenoshaSymphony.org. And Maestro Hasty, I know you have to get on the way to a day of teaching at Northwestern University, so we'll let you go as we listen to a little more Dvorak. I thank you for joining me today on this portion of the morning show. Great to talk to you as always, and we wish you well with Saturday night's concert.
Thank you, Greg, for helping get the word out to the community, and also the community should know that you helped me prepare one of the choirs. You were great.
It was fun.
You did a great job of translating a piano for four hands with just your two hands. And it still sounded like four hands when you played it. It was awesome.
Well, thanks for the compliment, and good luck with Saturday night.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you, Greg.
And here is a bit of that third movement of Dvorak's Symphony No. 9, the Symphony from the New World. This is a recording by Raphael Kubelik. The time is 8:32. This is the Thursday morning show on WGTD. And also this weekend, in addition to the Kenosha Symphony concert, there are also performances at the University of Wisconsin Parkside of by their opera workshop of The Sorcerer by Gilbert and Sullivan. This is a collaboration with the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin, and the performances are Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday afternoon at 3:30 p.m. in beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall on the campus of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Here is a brief little taste of this delightful score by Gilbert and Sullivan, the opening chorus, "Ring Forth, Ye Bells." A snippet from The Sorcerer by Gilbert and Sullivan. You can get information off of the Parkside website, uwp.edu, or the Choral Arts website, which is choralartsonline.org. We finish out today's Music Potpourri by talking with retired editor George Pepper from Golf Magazine about a book which he helped put together called The 500 World's Greatest Golf Holes. fascinating and beautifully put together celebration of the world of golf and some of the most interesting places in the world where you can play the great game.
This book, this publication, is the paperback version, if you can imagine that, of what was the 6.5-pound coffee table book. It's not substantially smaller, but it's probably $15 or $20 less. The original book came out about a year ago, and that the genesis of that book was for Golf Magazine to do something in commemoration of the Millennium celebration. And at first we had the ridiculous idea of doing the 2,000 best holes in the world, and that became so daunting that we had abandoned it. And then we came up with the notion of, well, what if the total par were 2,000? Ergo, 500 golf holes. There are 250 par fours. That's a total of 1,000. 125 par threes and 125 par fives, and that totals 2,000 altogether. So that was the genesis of the book.
Very good. And I know that this was a list that came about in a number of different ways. Before we get into that, for the sake of those of our listeners who know next to nothing about golf, I mean, I even know this, but maybe a few of our listeners need this clarified. What do we mean when we talk about a hole being par three or par four or par five?
Well, it's the number of strokes it should take a good golfer to complete the hole, essentially, including two putts. A par three is you reach the green in one shot, take two putts, and make three. Par four, reach it in two. Par five, reach it in three, take two putts.
There we go. Now let's take apart the title of the word a little of the book a little bit, because this is where it gets kind of interesting. This is not the 500 most challenging or most difficult holes in the world. This is not the 500 prettiest holes, I don't think. What are we talking about when we talk about the greatest? What kinds of qualities do these 500 holes share?
Well, it's a good question, and it really is no one quality, but kind of an amalgam of things, a couple of which you mentioned. Yes, difficulty is a factor. Beauty and what I like to call charm is also a factor. The history of the hole is plays a part. The strategy, how you have to think your way through it. Is the hole equally playable and enjoyable to a scratch golfer, you know, a pro-level player, and somebody who has trouble breaking 100? Really, all of those things go into it, and we didn't impose any one definition or set of criteria. What we did, in fact, was take a poll of Golf Magazine's readers and got several thousand nominations from around the country. And that helped us come up with the U.S. list, which constitutes probably two-thirds of the 500 holes. And at the same time, we went to our colleagues at golf publications around the world in Spain and France and Germany and the U.K. and Australia and Japan, all over the Far East, and asked them to do the same thing, to poll their readers and to vet the nominations of their readers as Golf Magazine's readers, editors did. And we came up with more or less of a list, maybe a 600 holes we're happy with. And the final stage was to go to the British Open and have kind of an international summit conference similar to what's going on with the G8 now, except they were all Golf Magazine editors. And we hammered out the last, took out the last 100 holes and got it down to 500 at that meeting.
I liked how you used the term summit conference to come up with this very final list. And I liked also the fact that you mentioned that it was with remarkably little bickering that you were able to winnow this down to the final 500.
Yeah, we may have taken a sort of American George Bush stance there, where we were kind of the world's policeman on this one and said, look, to countries like France and Germany, don't expect to get 100 holes here on the top 500. Most of them are going to come from America because, frankly, most golf courses are in America, and the preponderance of great golf courses are in America. So they had their expectations managed before they went in, and there was, and I think, a fair amount of agreement. It was an easy consensus.
Was it trickier to come up with the top 100 and the top 18?
Well, the top 18, of course, is excruciating. There are many, many more than 18 superb golf holes in the world. So that was probably the toughest list to come up with. Top 8, top 100, a little easier.
I appreciated the fact that you said there are no blueprints, literal or figurative, for great holes. They invariably are blends of art and science, nature and man. stubbornness and compromise, dedicated genius and dumb luck. Explain for a moment what dumb luck has to do with a certain golf hole being great.
Well, a good example is the is Pebble Beach, which, to my mind, is the best golf course in the world. Well, when the dumb luck there is the location. It's not really luck. The guy, developer Sam Moore, said, we're not going to put houses along the city. We're going to leave the best land for the golf course. But in terms of the golf course architect, he said, you know, when I walked this property, it was all there in plain sight. All I had to do is, you know, basically put a hole in the ground every 400 yards. It wasn't quite that simple, but he was pretty lucky to have a piece of land like that.
One of the things you say, in fact, it's at the top of your list, you talk about how a great hole invites the whole notion of strategy. Tell us a little bit more about how a given hole challenges a golfer in that way.
Well, my favorite holes are the kind that sort of tempt you and tease you from beginning to end. One of our top holes is the fifth at Mid-Ocean Country Club in Bermuda. It's one of the top 18. And it's played from an elevated tee. You can see the hole, the entire hole. It's a par four, dogleg left. But in order to get your ball, your drive into the fairway, you have to cross this huge pond. And the hole is oriented in such a way that, you can bite off as much of that pond as you want. And that is called a heroic hole. How much of a hero do you want to be? How much risk and reward do you want to bring into play? And the beauty of holes like that is there's usually a way to play it very safely and tack out away from the problem, or to take on as much of the hazard as you want. And that's a big and, I think, a really alluring part of strategy for me.
Right. That folds into something else which you say in the foreword, which is that maybe without exception, all of these holes offer sort of similar bounty to golfers of every level. I mean, that an absolutely top-flight pro would enjoy this sort of question of strategy, but also players of lesser ability, mere mortals, would also be able to enjoy these holes.
Right. I mean, there again, a good example would be another of our top 18 holes, and one that I suspect a lot of your listeners are familiar with, the 13th at Augusta National, the home of the Masters, which is a relatively short, barely 500 yards long par 5 that the pros in the Masters routinely go after with a driver and a middle iron these days, sometimes even a short iron. But the members who play it the rest of the year enjoy just as much by kind of bunting their drives out there 200 yards and bunting another one short of the green, the stream that guards the green, and then hitting a wedge or short iron on. It's a delight. It's a great tournament hole for the world's best players, but a great challenge for the handicapped golfer.
We're talking with George Pepper, recently retired as editor-in-chief of Golf Magazine and responsible for much of a magnificent book called The 500 World's Greatest Golf Holes. Mr. Pepper, you go on to talk about difficulty, of course, being of great interest here as well, and you talk about how a given hole being very difficult or not quite so difficult has to do with a lot of different factors, length being one of them, maybe the most important, but certainly not the only consideration. Tell us a little bit about that complex picture of what makes a given hole difficult or not.
Yeah, it really has something to do with, I guess you call it balance. You can have a green of a certain type, sort of average size, average contours and slopes. And if it comes at the end of a very long hole, it makes that hole a lot more difficult than if it comes at the end of a short hole. What I'm saying is basically the shot into the green should be proportional to the size of the green. And that's it's sort of a obscure, sometimes difficult to understand concept, but that's the way holes can be made difficult without just pure length. There's also that risk-reward factor. There's the bunkering. There's not just the length of the hole, but the width of the fairways. Again, the size of the green in comparison to the number of bunkers around it. The severity, as I say, the bunkers. The 17th hole at St. Andrews is a terrific example. They have this chasm of a pot bunker that sits right in front of the green. And that controls the mind and play of just about everybody who tees it up there.
Hmm. Yeah, you said that sometimes a hole has the ability to mess with our heads,
right,
especially right off the tee as you kind of look. You also said that sometimes holes are actually, when you sum it all up, are not particularly difficult, but they feel more difficult than they are, because if you make a mistake, the penalty can be very, very serious.
Right.
And just thinking about that, I suppose, can lead a golfer to make that mistake, which they otherwise wouldn't really need to make.
Well, yeah, another example is the 17th at the Tournament Players Course in Florida, the Island Green, maybe the most famous par 3 in the world. Johnny Miller once said, every great golf course needs a hole like 17 at TPC, a hole that makes your rear end pucker. And that's exactly what it does. From the moment, I don't care whether you're an amateur or you're Tiger Woods, you step onto that tee, if not the tee of the first hole, that shot to that Island Green is in your mind, and it's only 130-some yards, whatever, maybe 150. But the penalty for a miss is severe. You're either putting for your next shot, or there's a tiny little pot bunker, or you're in the water.
Hmm. You say at one point in this foreword that a great hole invites inspection and introspection. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, inspection, great hole, you look down the fairway and it talks back to you usually. And it said, here's where I'd like you to hit it. Here's where, if you have the guts, you can hit it. And here, if you don't have the guts, you can hit it over there. And that's kind of the introspection. How big a man am I? How smart am I? How stupid am I? It makes you question your own abilities and your own good sense. If a hole doesn't do that, it's pretty pedestrian.
Hmm. I really appreciated a distinction that you drew between some modern golf courses that are very much designed, scientifically designed, and a designer's idea is really sort of directed right onto the ground, whereas others are laid out much more naturally, just sort of exactly the way the land sort of invited itself. I guess that comes back to maybe what we talked about earlier a little bit with dumb luck. But some of the holes that we're talking about here are actually very old courses, which date back to that era, correct?
Of course, St. Andrews, it's 500-plus years old, and that just kind of evolved out of the winds blowing sand bunkers, and it was just very natural land, and nobody knows exactly who designed that. The game, and most of the courses, at least the links courses of the British Isles, are very natural way. In America, we do everything in a big and mechanical and expensive way, and that can mean millions of cubic yards of dirt being moved, and courses here cost $50 million plus very often, as they do in Japan, where the existence of usable land is minimal. There's a great variety in what goes on. On the other hand, there are some great courses being built now, notably the courses up in Bandon Dunes in Oregon, where there's been very little moving. Pacific Dunes, for instance, is the minimalist philosophy, where they're trying to get back to the look of the Great Links courses.
Hmm. You finish out the foreword of the book by saying that this list cannot be thought of as definitive. You certainly expect that it is controversial, but you also say very much that it is defensible. That's a wonderful way to look at this. I mean, it sort of underscores your right to come up with a list like this, but also the importance that you do it right.
Yeah, well, that I guess goes back to my magazine editor background, and people love lists, number one, and that's what sells a lot of magazines. You always see them on the covers, the 10 best of this, whatever. And I have always felt that the editors, magazines like Golf, have an obligation to their readers to kind of go out there and sort out what's good and what isn't good. I mean, but having done that and having said that, all it can be is defensible, not definitive. Golf courses are being built every day. New terrific holes are being constructed, and there are many, many more than 500 great golf holes in the world. We've just taken the 500 we think qualify at the moment.
Hmm. We're talking with George Pepper recently retired editor-in-chief of Golf Magazine, and we're talking about this spectacular book called The 500 World's Greatest Golf Holes. Mr. Pepper, this is one of those kind of ignorant questions, but I am assuming that many of these holes, maybe all of them, or nearly all of them, are not immediately or easily accessible to the general public. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, Greg, you'd be right, particularly with regard to the American holes. I would guess that somewhere between a quarter and a third of the holes, the American holes on the list, are public or resort courses. The other two-thirds are private. And the American holes, as I said, constitute about two-thirds of the 500. So that's tough. On the other hand, if you have the time and wherewithal to get yourself out of the U.S., I'd say probably 80 to 90% of the courses around the world are available, even though they're private. Many of them welcome travelers.
Wow. Your top 18 holes are really a sight to behold. And I'm wondering if they are in any particular order, those top 18 in particular.
No, not really. We just, all we tried to do was make a 72-hole golf course and essentially balance it that way. But, and again, try to have about two-thirds of the holes be from the U.S. and the remainder around the world.
Mm-hmm. A couple of them are on the seaside, on the seashore pretty much. And that brings to mind the question of, on any given day, how much does a given wonderful golf hole change according to the elements? And did that kind of variability weigh very heavily in some of these choices?
No, not really. A golf hole, about all it does, unless it's really in a wind-blown area where you can get sand and whatnot, it's on the seaside, or if it gets battered by a lot of rain. At golf hole, doesn't change much in the course of the day, except the grass grows, and you'd be surprised at what a change that can have on a very thick, rough. It can get actually thicker by the end of the day than it was in the early morning, and the speed of the greens as well can become slower as the grass grows. All I'd say is that I think holes, in my mind at least, I'm big on charm on golf holes, and a hole that is built up along the side of a sea or even a lake or a river has almost an unfair advantage in gaining notoriety.
Right. Well, and I'm wondering about the very first hole we see in your top 18, which is in Alberta, Canada, with these spectacular mountains in the background.
Yeah.
One wonders how you could even think about golf with that kind of breathtaking backdrop before
you. Well, you know, one of the great tenets when you play golf is keep your head down. And with a view like that, it has to be a true act of will.
You write rather almost provocatively about one of the holes in your top 18 at Pine Valley Golf Course in Clementon, New Jersey. You go so far as to say it is by popular consent the most fiendishly difficult golf course ever built. You go on to say that only a place like Clementon, New Jersey would host something like this or bring a golf course like this into being. Tell us a little bit more about that and what you mean.
Well, it's unique terrain there. It's called the Pine Barrens, and it's in kind of the middle of nowhere in New Jersey. It's kind of hard to get to, and it's a sort of a desert forest. It's coated with sand and very raw, rolling terrain. It was ideal terrain for a golf course. The guy who started it used to pass by it on a train on his way commuting to New York, and look longingly out there. And so they were able to build this course that calls for a lot of strong forced carries over this sand and scrub. Virtually every hole has some kind of demanding shot to be made, and they took great advantage of that. It's the fact is that the fairways and greens are pretty generous, but Pine Valley is the a great example of a golf course that looks, I think, even tougher than it is, and it, as a result, it intimidates people. There's an old saying, fearing leads to steering, and steering leads to veering. If you're afraid of the hole, you're going to make a bad swing and hit it out of bounds.
Huh.
And Pine Valley does that very successfully.
Right. Many of these holes evoke names that are familiar to even those of us that don't follow golf very clearly. I mean, when we see the Augusta National Golf Club, I mean, we know something about what that is in Augusta, Georgia, and St. Andrews in St. Andrews, Scotland. How much does history inject itself into these decisions? I mean, are some of these holes here not so much because of the actual physical reality of the hole or because of what history has unfolded there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think history and the playing of golf tournaments over the years on a particular course certainly spotlights great holes. And I suppose you could say that also is an unfair advantage. But I think in the case of the holes we've noticed here, they're unassailable. The 17th, as I said, the 17th at St. Andrews is a great golf hole if it were in the middle of Podunk, as would be the 13th hole at the Augusta National or the 7th hole at Pebble Beach. They're all well-known, and thank goodness they are because they're terrific holes.
Hmm. I have to say that my eyes kind of lit up when I saw Sandhills Club in Mullen, Nebraska.
Right.
Because, I mean, that's just kind of the I don't think one would necessarily assume that a golf hole in Nebraska was going to make the list. And indeed, it seems that you and your editors have been exceedingly careful to try to be as inclusive as possible in putting this together, and that you are not afraid to take us off the beaten path as far as the golf world is concerned.
Well, we tried, yes. We tried to be as inclusive as possible. Well, that was one of the reasons we polled the readers of the magazine for their favorite local places, and we tried to vet those and discover, find undiscovered gems. In the case of the Sandhills, however, Sandhills Golf Club, which was designed in 1995, I believe, was a Ben Crenshaw design, and it quickly jumped onto the top 100 golf courses in the world list at number 12. This place, truly in the middle of nowhere, you have to take like three plane flights to get there. But when you do, it's astonishing. It's in the middle of these wheat fields or whatever they are. You stand at any point on the golf course and you can twirl around and you see the same thing wherever you look. It's these, you know, amber waves of grain. But it's a wonderful golf course in the middle of it all.
Just one of a number of beautiful golf courses that are showcased in this gorgeous book called The 500 World's Greatest Golf Holes, published by Artisan and edited by George Pepper, a retired editor from Golf Magazine. Let's finish out the hour with one more little snippet from Gilbert and Sullivan's delightful operetta, The Sorcerer, which is being performed this Saturday night and Sunday afternoon at the University of Wisconsin Parkside in collaboration with the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. This is Now to the Banquet We Press. Information about these performances of The Sorcerer of Gilbert and Sullivan available at uwp.edu or choralartsonline.org. It's a minute before 9 o'clock. Professor Art Sear from Carthage College joins me tomorrow on the morning show for his monthly visit to the program. Support comes from Carthage College, hosting a children's literature book sale this Saturday, 9 to 1 in the Hedberg Library. The sale will feature children's and young adult books, hardcovers for $3, paperbacks on sale for $1. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Today, cloudier than it's been, with a 50% chance of showers this morning, a high of 60 degrees, cooler near the lake. Clear overnight with a low of 43 degrees. Tomorrow, under sunny skies, up to 73 degrees for a high. Well inland, mid-60s will be the high near Lake Michigan. Also partly sunny on Saturday, but cloudy with light rain on both Sunday and Monday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.